Hello, you're listening to Corpus Cast, the show all about corpus linguistics and what it can do for society. My name is Robbie Love, and I'm a lecturer in English language here at Aston University. I'm a corpus linguist, meaning that I study linguistic patterns, trends, and variations using large samples of language data. So on behalf of the Aston Corpus Linguistics Research Group, welcome to the show. In each episode of Corpus Cast, I interview top researchers in the field to find out more about how corpus linguistics can be applied in all sorts of contexts. And if you're watching us on YouTube, you'll see that we're back once again in the official Corpus Cast studio, where occasionally in the series, I'll be lucky enough to meet our guests face to face. I don't quite believe it, but we're actually celebrating the end of the first whole year of Corpus Cast. So if you've been with us since the beginning, thank you for staying with us. And if you're just joining us now for today's episode, welcome. And we're certainly looking forward to seeing what 2023 brings. Now, in today's show, our topic is television dialogue. The language of fictional television series is encountered by millions of viewers worldwide on their TVs, their computers, tablets, or phones. Streaming services like Netflix, Amazon Prime, and Disney Plus, among many others nowadays, have arguably become the main way in which many people watch TV shows. And our guest today is interested in what we can learn about the language of popular TV shows and how knowledge about the language of fictional TV characters can have applications that are anything but fictional. So our guest, Professor Monica Bednarik, is Professor of Linguistics and Director of the Sydney Corpus Lab at the University of Sydney, Australia. Monica's primary research interest is in corpus-based discourse analysis, focusing on English language media texts with two main strands, language used in the news and language used, as I said, in fictional TV series. She's the author of several books, including News Discourse with Helen Capel, The Language of Fictional Television, and Language and Television Series. Now, when I emailed Monica to invite her onto Corpus Cast, I never imagined that we'd be able to do it sitting side by side, face to face, due to the great distance between the UK and Australia. But by a stroke of good fortune, at least for me, Monica finds herself here in Birmingham at the moment. And so it's my great pleasure to welcome to Corpus Cast Professor Monica Bednarik. Hello, Monica. Thank you so much for doing this. And thank you for coming to Aston in person, which was very much unexpected. But it's great to have you here.
It's a great pleasure, Robbie. And thanks for having me on the podcast.
So thank you. It is really exciting, actually, because otherwise you are all the way over in Sydney, and you have been for obviously over COVID and everything. And so it's great that you're here visiting the University of Birmingham at the moment, and working with corpus linguists there. So why don't we start, I suppose, at the beginning. What does corpus linguistics mean to you?
Wow, it's a really good question. You know, for me, corpus linguistics is a lot of things. So I would say, yes, on the one hand, it's just it's an approach or methodology. But I really think it's more than that. You know, it gives us a set of theoretical principles, analytical principles as well, that we can use when we do our research. It gives us, you know, the evidence for the claims that we're making about language. And, you know, one of the things that I think is particularly important is that we can look at the history of corpus linguistics now, and we can see that certain theories about language have been developed within the approach or discipline or whatever you want to call it of corpus linguistics. And I think it's really important not to forget those theoretical aspects as well. But at the same time, I think the methodological aspects are obviously also really important. The corpus linguistic techniques that we can use, the corpus design principles as well. In particular, I think sometimes, again, we forget about those, that there's a lot of like a big body of research that's been written about how do we design a corpus, notions such as what makes this data set representative of the language variety that we want to study. And so I think for me, it's not just one thing, it's many things at the same time. And also, I suppose, it's just a way into language. I really like some of the metaphors that people have used, or images, if you will, you know, whether you look at corpus linguistics as a telescope or, you know, whatever, kaleidoscope or whatever it is. But personally, I also like combining corpus linguistics with other approaches. just because I think there's no one approach that always gives us like the full picture.
Yeah. And how did you get into this, which, you know, in the grand scheme of things might be considered fairly niche interest? How did it start for you? Take me back to the beginning of your career.
I mean, I'd say probably, I mean, today maybe it's this niche, but yeah, when I started, I did actually encounter corpus linguistics during my master's degree, which was, which I undertook in Germany, but I didn't take a class in corpus linguistics at that point, but I knew of it and there were classes offered on corpus linguistics at that time, which was sort of late 90s, early 2000s. And then I didn't really pursue that during my MA. I focused more on pragmatics, discourse analysis, even cognitive linguistics. Then I decided to do a PhD in the area of looking at the expression of opinion. And as part of that, I spent some time, I think it was maybe 8 months at the University of Birmingham, working with Susan Hanston. And during that time, I audited a lot of classes in corpus linguistics. And I think, you know, that really got me into corpus linguistics, doing it, you know, using it, applying it. And I mean, I didn't, so the work that I was doing during my PhD still involved a lot of manual discourse analysis. It involved some corpus linguistic techniques as well, but it's really only in my second book, which is the Emotion Talk Across Corpora, which looks at how emotion is expressed in the English language. That's when I really started getting into corpus linguistics, but that was really still based on that sort of training and encounter with corpus linguistics that I had while I was a visiting scholar at the University of Birmingham during that time. And ever since then, I've just continued, you know, I think we continue to develop as linguists throughout our careers, or at least I hope we do. I would like to do that. And so I still now experiment with corpus linguistics and combining it with different theoretical approaches or other kinds of methods in linguistics as well. And that's actually also one of the things that I love about corpus linguistics is there's always something new that you can explore and a new direction that you can take.
So, of course, we're going to dive into one of the sort of big strands of your research, looking at television dialogue. But we fast forward from those early days and look at the present day. You're now the director of Sydney Corpus Lab. And I wonder if you could tell us a bit more about the initiative behind that and the overall kind of direction that that center is moving in.
Yeah, sure. So the lab is really about promoting corpus linguistics in Australia. And I really like that aspect of it, that it is about community building. It's about building capacity in corpus linguistics, specifically in Australia, but of course, you know, always with the view to international collaboration as well. So what we do is we try to do some events. Of course, it was a little bit disrupted by COVID, as you can imagine, but we started out with a bang. We started with a bang, I think, in 2019. We had a symposium to launch the lab. And we still now we've started doing a few more events now that it's become a little bit less stressful, I should say. So we've got events on the one hand that includes sort of more training events like workshops, but we also have guest lectures by academics, most often with a focus on Australia, Australian English, for example, but not just, also other aspects of Australian languages. So we have these events. We also have sometimes other types of training that we offer that might be online. I have a blog post series that I'm sort of initiated to showcase the work of people who do corpus linguistics in Australia. And sometimes it's my students, sometimes it's other people's students, sometimes it's researchers at other universities, just to give people a little bit of a glimpse of the corpus linguistics that is going on in Australia, but also, yeah, to build this community, to give people a more informal outlet to write about what they're doing. And I found that I myself have learned a lot through that as well. And I'm still trying to think of, you know, what will be the most useful in terms of these blog posts to feature. And so I've got a few ideas for next year. We'll see what's going to happen. We also do research capacity building through a project that is funded by what's called the Australian Research Data Commons. And that involves more the use of text analytics. computational tools for analyzing data set. But it's particularly interesting there to think about the connection to corpus linguistics and how is it, for example, a text analytics approach, but also how can you use corpus linguistics to get people in this mindset in terms of thinking about what kinds of questions can you actually ask when you start using computer-based methods to look at language. I think that's always a really good way into this sort of thinking. The other thing that I have is a mailing list, which again, you know, is really all about community building, and we use it to publicize events, not necessarily just in Australia, but just events that might be of interest to Australian corpus linguists. So that might include also conferences overseas and so on. And then, of course, we try to support researchers in Australia if they have particular questions, or we just try to support Australian linguistics also by just doing particular projects on aspects to do with Australian Englishes, for example, or other kinds of questions that people ask in other disciplines. So it just depends. But ultimately, basically, the goal is to really offer a nice community for corpus linguists in Australia to encourage the research, but not necessarily at the expense of other types of research. So it's very, very open and flexible, and hopefully people will find it of interest.
Absolutely. And you know, there's an awful lot of activity that you've got going on there, and so many different strands to the work of your lab and also your own research pathway, I suppose. News language is a whole other thing, and I wish we could talk about that as well, and maybe one day we will. But we're going to focus on TV shows now, and of course that's something that probably an awful lot of people are very familiar with, but maybe not really thinking about it from a linguistic perspective. So what drew you into applying linguistic methods, and specifically corpus linguistic methods, to the language of TV shows?
So, I mean, why using corpus linguistics methods? I mean, that's the easier question to answer, because that's sort of at this point, you know, I had this interest in corpus linguistics and corpus-based discourse analysis, and obviously interest in the kinds of insights that you can gain through that method. But what made me interested in television dialogue in the first place? I mean, I think it goes back quite a while. I mean, so I grew up in Germany, and as a teenager, I still remember one of the very few ways in which I could encounter English language was actually through television. I mean, at that point, it was quite rare. I mean, we didn't have, there was no streaming, there was no internet. we had some shows that we could get in English through satellite TV or other ways. But so I managed to encounter spoken English through this medium of television dialogue. And that is sort of, I guess, an experience that has always stayed with me as a language learner myself.
What was your favorite show growing up?
Oh, I had a lot of favorite shows, but Star Trek Next Generation.
Okay.
I shall say that's one way in which I encountered, through which I actually encountered Shakespeare, because if you are familiar with the show, you know that Jean-Luc Picard, the captain, often cites Shakespeare. So I remember that quite distinctly. But yeah, there were many other shows. It's probably too embarrassing to mention them. So that's sort of more of a personal, a personal experience as a learner, even though my work on television dialogue doesn't so much focus on language learning and teaching, but it is just this general idea of here's a source of language that is a lot of people are exposed to all around the world, especially if you look at the kinds of series that come from the United States that are exported, syndicated everywhere. And even for, you know, not necessarily for learners of English, also for other speakers of other language varieties, for example. And, you know, they will encounter this sort of language to a larger extent that they might encounter someone speaking in a casual conversation. So I was always interested in the fact that, so we have this is a fact, but at the same time, at that point when I started out with this research, there was very, very little linguistic description of this type of language. So sort of, you know, here's this linguistic phenomenon and we are not analyzing it. We don't have enough knowledge about it. And so for me, that was something that we really need to address. There are also other, you know, a lot of other reasons so, you know, I think television dialogue is also really important for other reasons. So issues of social representation, that we look at how are language varieties represented in television mm-hmm. series, and what does that tell us about the language attitudes and also ideologies that people have. You know, there's a lot of richness to the data, I should say. And I just feel like this means that we should analyze it. We should be able to describe it just so that we get a better understanding. It's also constantly in flux. So you can see how there's this dialectic relationship, sort of reciprocal relationship between language and society, and one reflecting the other. And that's interesting as well. Mm. So, yeah, so those, I guess, are some of the reasons. I've always been interested in popular culture and why, you know, some people have perhaps shied away from analyzing it, because maybe they saw a danger of, you know, being tainted by the popular brush. But I've always felt that that's not a good reason to not analyze it.
So you've developed this corpus, the Sydney corpus of television dialogues, or SidTV, yeah. I think is a great name. Tell us a bit about how you built this and what it represents and what you have already done with it, perhaps, or what you hope people might do with it now that it's available for people to use?
Yeah, sure. So I developed the corpus because at that point there wasn't really a corpus that I could use, particularly a corpus that would have fulfilled the variables that I wanted it to fulfill. So it's a corpus that is representative of US American TV series, so it doesn't have any British data mm-hmm. in it, for example. And that was a decision that I made at that point when I started out, because as I mentioned earlier, a lot of series are exported from the US, and that was one of my interests in that as well, just the sheer amount of US television dialogue that gets exported. I wanted to have a corpus that is not just representative of one or a few shows, but something that is representative of, say, let's call it recent now. I wouldn't say it's contemporary. Mm. It's sort of recent television dialogue, and across television series that are targeted adults, so not kids, across sort of drama and comedy genres. So not just one genre, but different kinds of genres. And particularly also one thing that was interesting, and which is probably a sort of relatively special feature of the corpus, is that because television series are serial narratives, you also need to consider the text, what we might call textual time. So, you know, where you have a first episode, you have episodes in the middle, you have the final episode, and different, you know, there's different narrative progression often. I mean, it depends on the type of genre that you're looking at. But in the cases where you have a serial narrative, that can be interesting, and pilot or the first episode in particular often has particular functions. So what I also wanted to make sure was that you have a mix of different types of episodes represented in the corpus, from really first episodes, last episodes, early episodes, episodes in the middle. So that made it a bit more complicated. And the other thing, I think the other major factor, was that I wanted to look at so-called quality television as well as so-called mainstream television. And so I had to think about how to operationalize that. In the end, I did it through sort of awards, looking at shows that had either been nominated for a particular kinds of television awards or had won the awards. And so after I'd considered all of these variables, I basically tried to compile a corpus that was relatively balanced with respect to all of these variables. And the other thing is that it includes cable and sort of more network broadcast television, which is important for a variety of reasons, because they're governed by different kinds of rules and regulations, which can then impact on language. However, so I said earlier, it's not really representative of contemporary television, because, for example, there are actually no shows that were originally created for streaming services. That is because, you know, it's taken quite a while to build the corpus.
It's
time consuming, because a lot of the episodes were basically transcribed from scratch. So it has some dialogue from 66 different series, 66 different episodes from the first season each.
So it's not the scripts.
No,
transcripts of the output, the actual end product.
So I was always interested in, even though, you know, I think scripts or, you know, screenplays or whatever you want to call them are interesting products in their own right, but I was always interested in the language that the audience encounters as they are watching the characters, you know, on television in the narrative, rather than the screen directions and, you know, that that the screenwriters are writing.
So did you transcribe them all yourself?
No, I was very lucky that I had some funding. Over the years, I mean, that's another reason why it took a while. You know, I had little pots of funding over time, and so built it up over time. But that was, yeah, that was very lucky. And so, yeah, I had a few research assistants over the years who helped me transcribe the data. And of course, you know, the transcription isn't, you know, the type of detailed transcription that, for example, you might undertake in conversation analysis. So you always have to have a think about the trade-off between the detail of linguistic transcription and the amount of data and funding that you have. I mean, I don't need to tell you this. you probably know that.
All too aware of my sins.
Yes.
So let's, you know, you've got the data and, you know, I'm imagining you sitting down wondering, right, I'm going to start looking at it now. What is the, a defining set of linguistic features that you've been able to identify and go, that's the stuff that makes it distinctively, you know, TV dialogue, characters on a TV show talking? What are the sort of features that stand out as opposed to other genres of speech, so to speak?
Now that's a good question. I mean, the first thing that I mean, prior to working with this corpus, I had actually worked on television dialogue, but with respect to more specific narratives. So when I then had this corpus that is more representative of this language variety, that was one of the first things that I did do, that I wanted to see, okay, let's look at the previous studies that have already identified some features, but mostly they did it on the basis of looking at particular series, and we might not necessarily be able to generalize from that, right? Because the results could just be limited to this particular show, this particular narrative, these particular characters, or this particular genre. So I did look at, I used corpus linguistic methods, of course, mostly starting by looking at sort of keywords, so words that are unusually frequent in TV dialogue compared to unscripted conversation. But I also looked at it from a more sort of functional perspective, I suppose. So I guess, you know, it's hard to come up with one defining feature. There's a range of things that television dialogue does that is different to what happens when we speak in unscripted conversation. But one of the major issues, one of the major functions is obviously to entertain the audience. And so we will have emotionality, expressivity, entertainment as quite important. So the dialogue often functions in these particular ways. There could be positive emotion, it could be, you know, humor, it could be conflict, it can be drama. And so we have a lot of words in television dialogue that includes swearing, for example, but it also includes, you know, adjectives. It includes other types of emotional resources, and they tend to be quite highly frequent in this data, showing us the emotionality of the characters and therefore drawing the audience into the whole plot and into the characters themselves, allowing us to identify with them, to feel with them. So that's one thing. The other thing that you can see is that television dialogue tends to be fairly comprehensible and intelligible. So there's a tendency towards more what we might call language varieties that the audience is more familiar with. But at the same time, you also see if language varieties are represented that are maybe less familiar, then they tend to be more stereotypical and more exaggerated, again, with the aim of maybe making sure the audience recognizes who these characters are supposed to be, or with the intention of creating humor or other kinds of effects. We also see that we can also see that in terms of how people pronounce their words, you know, that's quite different as well. And a tendency towards, shall we say, coherence or fluency. So there's not an absence of these features. I mean, we do find some of the features that we find in ordinary conversation, like hesitation, interruptions, that sort of thing, but they tend to be less frequent. One of the things that I should point out is, of course, you know, these are all tendencies or trends, and not all TV shows will be the same. There are innovative shows that try to use language in a more realistic way. There are shows that try to represent particular language varieties more accurately. So it's also interesting to see how that's going to develop. It also depends on what kind of genre you're looking at, you know, drama or comedy. So there'll be differences between types of dialogue depending on the genre, depending on the actual narrative itself. Like, who are these characters actually?
Because
you know, the characters also use language in a way that reflects their kind of characteristics, whether that's sort of personality characteristics or other kind of social characteristics. And so, you know, we can make certain generalizations, but they are really generalizations and they are trends. And it doesn't mean you will always find these features in every particular show that you're analyzing.
You mentioned earlier on, you know, your own story anecdotally of learning English through, in a way, seeing especially these American TV shows. And I know in your work, you've identified that this is a very sort of common story for many people who are learning English as a foreign language. You mentioned there about the fluency and the clarity and the fact that it is, you know, largely scripted, right? So it's pre-prepared and it's delivered with clarity. In terms of potentially the sort of application or one possible application of this sort of research, is this something that, you know, is helpful in a way for learners who, compared to observing L1 speakers talking naturally, which will have all of these casual conversational features of so-called disfluencies, is seeing, you know, people talking in a way that is perhaps more, perhaps easier to process, that's surely that must be helpful? Or is there a trade-off with the fact that it's less natural, so to speak?
I mean, to be honest, it's not really exactly my area of research, but there is a lot of research that looks exactly at that. They look at, you know, what's the use of TV shows, for example, for people acquiring words, vocab acquisition. There's research that looks at, for example, one of the advantages, another advantage of a TV series would be that you can turn on subtitles, right? So you can either have same language subtitles or you can have the subtitles in your first language. And so there are certain advantages that other advantages as well, in addition to the sort of comprehensibility that the TV shows do offer. Also accessibility, of course. I mean, we can immerse ourselves into the language of another country by going there, but we might not always have that opportunity. So the easy accessibility, especially now, I mean, these days is better than when I was a teenager. That's certainly also an advantage. So, you know, I mean, if you're using it, there's also a difference in terms of whether you're using it on your own just by watching television or whether you're using it in a guided program at school where, you know, I think the teacher can maybe also make it more effective. But yeah, so in terms of the actual sort of research experiments, I'm not sure, just because it's not totally an area that I've worked in.
You also mentioned swearing, and that's something that I've done a little bit of work on in my own research, but naturally anyway, it's just something that's always quite fun to think about. What have you found about how TV characters swear, and is this changing over time, I suppose, in the context of changes in maybe other certain words that were not so acceptable earlier, which are now? Tell us a bit about what you've looked at with swearing.
Yeah, so first of all, remember that I'm looking at American television, so I wouldn't necessarily know about, as we know, there are certain words that are more British than American. I haven't done the diachronic research because my corpus is a, you know, contemporary corpus, so it, you know, doesn't look at change over time, but other people have certainly looked at it, and they have found, which, you know, is probably not going to surprise you, but they found that sort of milder swear words have become more acceptable over time, and so they've lost some of their taboo nature that they might have had in the past, and that's one development. But then at the same time, if you do look at television corpora or television subtitle corpora, you will also find that the frequency of stronger swear words has increased. But the reason is because we've had these huge changes in the television industry. So we, you know, as I mentioned, in the context of the US, there are certain actually rules and regulations around the use of swearing. But those rules apply differently to whether you're looking at network television or cable and streamers. And so the rise of cable and streaming services has meant that there are more shows that are not censored. So therefore, we have more of these words in a corpus. If you just look at it from the point of corpus composition, that's an influence there as well. In terms of the research that I've done myself, well, this is exactly one of the differences that I've found. So, you know, if you want to say, okay, what's the most frequent word? It actually really depends on whether you're looking at censored television or uncensored television.
Yeah, okay.
It also depends, you know, what you define as a swear word. Mm-hmm. I mean, would you include, for example, words, well, interjection uses of God? Would you say, oh my God, is a swear word? If we do include it, then that's actually the most frequent.
So, okay, right.
Oh God, oh my God, you know, all of these uses of God as interjection, they are very frequent across different programs. Also, they occur both in censored series as well as in uncensored series. Also, other sort of milder swear words like hell, for example, it also occurs. It often occurs in particular structures like what the hell, why the hell, you know, who the hell. Yeah. So these particular linguistic structures you can observe. Then if you look at the stronger swear words, they're still not allowed to occur in network and broadcast television. So that there will be zero occurrences. So the extent to which you as a viewer would encounter these particular swear words really does depend on what you're consuming. And even within the sort of uncensored television shows, you will see variation. I mean, I think if people who watch a lot of television will intuitively know this, because they know, okay, yeah, in this show they swear all the time, whereas in this show it's also from the same, maybe from the same production company, but there's much less use of swearing, because it really depends. I mean, swearing isn't really gratuitous. I mean, that's one of the things that I've looked at as well. What are the functions of swearing? And you know, a lot of the time it fulfills particular functions for the narrative. I mean, one function is just to tell us about like the emotion that the character is feeling at this point in time, but it can also tell us something about, say, their age. It can tell us some, you know, it can be used to construct their personality. Even characters who don't use swear words, you know, who use, for example, euphemism like gosh or something instead of the swear word, even that then has a function of tell us something about this character. This is a character who would not use swear words.
So
that's another thing that I found really interesting to analyze is, well, okay, you know, rather than just looking, say, at the frequency and the variation, what are they used for? And they're really quite multifunctional. And I suggest that that's maybe one reason why they are relatively frequent is because they are so multifunctional. They can, you know, they can also bring in the audience as well. But of course, you know, they do have the potential to offend some people. But yes, that also totally depends on the type of swear words that is included. And I mean, these days, slur words are probably more offensive to most people than technical swear words.
I'd say. And I wonder if there's an effect of genre, right? Say a crime thriller as opposed to a comedy series. I suppose maybe frequency potentially isn't affected in terms of the ranking of the most popular, but perhaps from a functional perspective, as you say, I wonder if that, have you looked at that or?
I haven't looked at genre variation as far as I remember. I can't remember right now, but I've definitely looked at, you know, even if you look at particular words, you'll find that some words have quite a lot of variation across particular shows, just in terms of, you know, outliers because some of the and those outliers might be there just because of particular characters, particular sweary characters. But yeah, I mean, it does really also depend on the narrative world. You know, who are the characters in this narrative world?
Yeah.
And are they the sort of characters or speakers that we would expect to swear in real life as well? So, you know, what is the narrative world? Is it a professional world? You know, if it's a professional world, you know, it depends on the kind of profession, obviously, but, you know, if it's a narrative world centering around a profession where you wouldn't expect swear words to be used because they are maybe formal context, then of course you'll find less swear words there. You know, and well, that's just one example of how that, so it interacts with a lot of factors. It might interact with genre, but it also interacts with the narrative world and interacts particularly with whether it's a censored program or an uncensored program.
I want to sort of ask you to take a stance on an issue that I've been thinking about, which is, you know, looking at corpora of fictional TV dialogue or film scripts or, you know, subtitle or the actual output. You know, there are some who sort of encourage the use of these often can be quite large data sets if you get lots and lots and lots of scripts and put them together, almost as a proxy for casual, you know, naturally occurring casual conversation. Then there might be other people who would sort of say, well, hang on a minute, is it the same? You know, should we consider scripted fictional conversation to be accepted as a window through which to research natural language? So I sort of wonder which side of the fence you sit with this, because I find it quite interesting that sometimes you do see some people making claims about sort of natural conversation based on data that is, you know, essentially scripted fictional language. And are the similarities enough to kind of make that claim of them being part of the same genre or register of language? I wonder what you think about this.
I mean, I'm not too much a fan of just the words authentic and natural. I prefer probably scripted and unscripted, because you can see, you know, there are scripted versions of language that occur in more in non-media contexts, but also in other media contexts. But going back to the question, I mean, for me, television dialogue is, you know, a particular language variety. That's one of the things that I've done in my research, that I've tried to say, okay, what is this language variety? What are the features of this specific language variety? Mm. And, you know, it is a scripted language variety. If you look at the kinds of features that it does have, you know, of course, there are some similarities with unscripted language. So especially if you look, and that other research has shown this, so, you know, especially if you look at lexis, some grammatical structures as well.
Yeah.
You'll find similarities, you know, but it's a selective imitation. It's a partial imitation. You also need to consider the differences. But I also think that it's not, you know, we don't need to just look at television dialogue because it's a proxy or something for you know, unscripted language. Mm. Well, I think it's precisely interesting to analyze television dialogue because it is an example of media language. Yeah. And we should be looking at it as an example of media language. And that can give us really rich insights as well. I mean, yes, we should, you know, we should, it's a good idea to look at its features, and it's probably also a good idea to compare it to unscripted conversation to figure out, okay, what exactly are the similarities? What are the differences? Where can television dialogue perhaps be useful, for example, in language learning and teaching, you know, to help learners to understand how unscripted conversation might work. But at the same time, we also do need to be aware of the differences, you know, whether that's in relation to turn-taking or other kinds of things. I mean, it really depends also. If you look at the studies, some of the studies that find similarities, you know, they don't necessarily look at all features of language. So it really, I guess we have to be just careful in terms of the claims that we make. But yeah, for me, it is a particular kind of language variety. And interesting to look at for those reasons. And we need to consider, you know, the functions, the media context. Mm. I mean, that's all part of what we might, some people call media linguistics, right? Is that you're doing media linguistics when you actually consider the aspects of the medium as well, not just the language, you know, they're the two aspects to it. So that's, I guess, my own stance, is that I prefer to look at it as an example of a particular language variety. Mm. But, you know, I still think that doesn't mean that we can deny that there are certain similarities.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
But it is, it is a way of, I mean, I'm hoping other people will use the data to do research that, you know, I haven't done. I'm at the moment using corpus linguistics more to look at Australian data. So I'm not currently not using the CIT-TV corpus. For my own research, and that's another reason why I hope that other people are going to continue to use it, because it was very time consuming to construct it, and it was carefully constructed. And I really do hope that others can use it. It doesn't have to be in research, it could also be in their teaching, you know, it could be students who use it, and any kind of pedagogic uses would also be useful. I mean, for example, if people want to, I think, you know, teach about critical literacy, even in relation to things like swearing, and how that might be used, or the representation of particular kinds of language variety. So I think there's lots and lots of different applications in teaching as well as in research, hopefully.
And presumably from a sort of critical discourse perspective, not only representation of varieties, but representation of social groups and societal structures and things like that, that must be a lot that would be revealed through looking at that data.
I mean, it depends, you know, obviously that's limited by the transcription detail, but I mean, that's another reason why the transcription isn't necessarily super detailed. I always thought that people could use it as a starting point and then do their own follow-up transcription as well that is more detailed and focuses on specific aspects. So you could use the corpus to find particular instances, and then you could use, you know, go to the data yourself and do more detailed transcription. I have looked a little bit at this in relation to stigmatized language, so particularly looking at the word ain't and looking at, you know, who are the kinds of characters that use ain't, because that's it's quite stigmatized, and especially in the US context. And so there's many more applications, I think, similar to that, or also others. But also people hopefully will be encouraged to maybe create their own corpora that allow them to answer their own research questions, because that corpus, like, you know, a lot, we can't answer all research questions, but I'm hoping that it'll be useful anyway.
So I want to sort of move on a little bit to potentially an area of application, although I don't know, so I'm asking, that's why I'm asking you, because you as I mentioned, you've published many books throughout your career, but there's one that to me stands out a little bit from the others. It's really a series of interviews that you conducted in the book Creating Dialogue for TV, Screenwriters Talk Television. And you interviewed, I think, five Hollywood screenwriters who'd worked on some really, really big and well-known shows about how they write, how do they actually write for TV. So I suppose, first of all, how did you persuade these sort of high-flying Hollywood scriptwriters to spend time talking to a linguist?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, so, I mean, I was visiting the United States when I did these interviews, so that was helpful to start with. So this is part of my bigger project to look at television dialogue from different perspectives, so not just looking at the television dialogue as we encounter it, but also looking at how is this dialogue actually created, and then also how it is consumed. And so I always wanted to have interviewed with screen, but I didn't know if I was going to achieve it. What I knew was that there was a screenwriter, Jane Espenson, who herself had a linguistics background. And so I actually just tweeted her and sort of just said, look, you know, I basically explained who I was and whether we could continue the conversation off Twitter, so by email. And, you know, she was very kindly got in touch. And then we had some conversation via email about, you know, the ethics application and things like that in the project itself. And I started with a long interview with her in LA, which was fantastic. And, you know, because of her linguistics background, she was clearly interested in talking about it, and she had a you know, really interesting insights as well. And then I asked her who she recommended I talk to. And so obviously she had much more insights in that community in terms of which screenwriters or scriptwriters, however you whatever term you might want to use, might be willing, interested in talking to me. And so I then proceeded to contact the people that she suggested, and some of them, you know, said no, and some of them said yes. And so, yeah, I did some of the interviews in person. So, for example, you know, I went to Warner Brothers to the screenwriter's office to interview them, and some I ended up still doing via Zoom rather than face-to-face, just because of where I was located in relation to LA and other kinds of concerns. But they were all, you know, very happy to have this conversation. I mean, a lot of the time, I think the interest that they get from the general public might be, well, the interest might be in the actors. You know, the actors are the ones that people might fawn about. So it's probably also an opportunity for them to talk about their craft that, you know, some at least relish. And yeah, I'm very grateful to the screenwriters that have talked to me. They were all really friendly, and you know, I'm so grateful that they gave their time to the project.
It must have been fascinating to get the chance to really pick their brains about their process.
Yes.
And I suppose I'm curious about how receptive they were. You know, that nowadays, of course, applied corpus linguistics is a real a really big area, and that would seem to be finding more and more ways of taking insights from corpus research and using them to inform an area of communication related practice. So do you see that as a similar sort of route in terms of, could the work that you and others have done analyzing the TV dialogue somehow inform what they do? And I don't want to say improve, because obviously these are very talented people who clearly have a track record of producing really successful TV shows. So I'm not sure if improve is the right word, but is there a way in there to somehow contribute, do you think?
So what I actually did is I took the insights that were gained from the linguistics research, corpus linguistics research, as well as some of the insights from the screenwriters, and I actually developed a screenwriting tip sheet. And I then distributed through the Screenwriting Research Network, which is a network that includes people doing research in screenwriting, but also practitioners who teach screenwriting. So this is more about teaching novices who are not necessarily yet established screenwriters. And so that's where I would see one of the applications. And it has been viewed, you know, almost 2,000 times. So, I mean, there seems to be at least an interest, because I also didn't find, you know, there are screenwriting handbooks, but I didn't find much of a linguistic perspective in these handbooks. And so, you know, I thought, well, I'll give this a go, and I'll just do a little bit of a, you know, screenwriting tip sheet based on these insights. And yeah, you know, I think it's being used. I think it's being used in teaching, because I've had some positive feedback from people saying, oh, yes, great, this will be great for my teaching this semester. Mm-hmm. I haven't done a systematic, you know, evaluation of impact or anything like that, but I definitely see that as one application, so screenwriting pedagogy in that sense. More generally, in terms of application, I also think it has applications for the curriculum and in other disciplines. So even actually in linguistics, I think, for example, stylistics obviously is one area where, you know, we might also look at things like characterization, not just in literary texts, but also in televisual narratives or drama. Also social linguistics, because you can look at these issues that I mentioned earlier, like social representation, language ideologies, again, in that particular mediated context. So that, I think, has a role for the curriculum, but also in the English language classroom, with, you know, limitations in terms of how that is presented. And people have used it even in general introductions to linguistics, as there's actually quite a few examples of that around. So those are some practical applications, particularly, I guess, that I've thought about in relation to the curriculum. I don't know if established screenwriters would find in the insights useful or not. I think it probably depends on the established screenwriter and their view on this kind of work. I think one of the things that they would possibly find interesting is just some of the findings around, say, frequency that, you know, they might not necessarily know, and then that can be helpful. I mean, also in relation to the work that you mentioned earlier, news discourse, you know, it's always good to know what is frequent, whether you want to imitate that or whether you want to avoid it. So, you know, but having that information, I think, would be useful. Just in general. I mean, things like, some of it also coincides with actually advice that is given in screenwriting handbooks, things like around the use of names. And yeah, so I think linguistics can provide particular insights that maybe other kinds of perspectives on screenwriting can't.
Have you ever, this might be a bit of a weird question, have you ever had a go at writing something yourself?
Or? No. actually, this is wrong.
Okay, here's
very
a story.
Very embarrassing fact. When I was younger, I won't say how young or how old, I did once write a fan fiction episode of The X-Files. So that was my one and only attempt.
So you can email it to Gillian Anderson and see what she thinks of it, right?
I don't think it exists anymore anywhere in either digital or print
form.
Oh,
that's a shame, but probably for the best for your
sake,
right?
Probably for the best, yes, definitely.
Oh, brilliant. Okay, we're going to start to wrap things up here. And those who have been following us for a few episodes already will know that we like to finish with some quick questions about corpus linguistics. So now it's Monica's turn in the hot seat. There's three of them, okay? quick questions, and we'll see how quick the answers are, all right? So the first one is, what is the biggest change that you've noticed in corpus linguistics since the beginning of your career?
I'd say just the incredible growth, and to, you know, together with that growth, like diversification into all the different areas of linguistics. For me, that's the biggest change. I know there are other kind of qualitative changes, but for me, that's the one that I would pick.
Brilliant. Number two, what is the biggest misconception of corpus linguistics that you've encountered?
Well, a few years ago, I was in a meeting and someone referred to corpus linguistics as, oh, isn't that just Google Ngrams?
Oh, okay.
So I guess for me, that would be the conception that, you know, you don't have to have a very specific kind of training and theoretical and methodological know-how to do corpus linguistics, and also that it is just about counting or quantitative information, where it does also include qualitative analysis. So, yeah.
That's a, I'm finding quite a common common response to that question. Finally, and hopefully to end on a rather, I suppose, an optimistic note, how do you see corpus linguistics continuing, I suppose, to make an impact on the world in the future?
Yeah, so, you know, I think it actually really depends on how corpus linguistics is going to develop. So, you know, the world is such a big term, right? So,
yeah, a bit dramatic maybe, I apologize.
Well, you know, I think it just depends. What languages is corpus linguistics going to be impacting? You know, that's going to have an impact on how corpus linguistics is going to develop the world. What other disciplines are corpus linguists going to collaborate with? Other disciplines are going to be open to corpus linguistics. That's going to impact, I think, on the impact as well. And, you know, the kinds of collaborations that corpus linguists have, and also I think the institutional support for it. So I don't like to make kind of bold predictions for the future, but I think it will continue to have an impact on the world, and hopefully a positive one. But I think we should just continue to reflect on, you know, where else can we go? What else, you know, what directions should we continue to pursue, but also what are the new directions that we should pursue as well?
I like that. A suitably non-committal but positive and optimistic response. Okay, well, that does bring us to the end of this episode of CorpusCast and the final episode of 2022. So thank you for joining us. However you have accessed us, whether that's on YouTube, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Podcast Addict, or Podchaser, please do let us know your thoughts about this and all the other episodes of CorpusCast using the hashtag CorpusCast, and make sure to check out the Aston Corpus Linguistics Research Group on Twitter at Aston Corpus. CorpusCast is an Aston Originals podcast written and hosted by me, Robbie Love, and produced by Sam Cook. So thank you again for listening. And of course, the biggest thanks goes to today's guest, Monica Bednarik from the University of Sydney. Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Robbie.